contained only three flowers, a full-blown Belle of Portugal rose, shell pink with a hint at every petal's base of a hotter, flamier hue, a large magenta and cream-colored carnation, and, pale purple at the end of its broken stalk, the bold heraldic blossom of an iris. Fortuitous and provisional, the little nosegay broke all the rules of traditional good taste. At breakfast that morning, I had been struck by the lively dissonance of its colors, but that was no longer the point. I was not looking now at an unusual flower arrangement. I was seeing what Adam had seen on the morning of his creation, the miracle, moment by moment, of naked existence. "Is it agreeable?" somebody asked. During this part of the experiment, all conversations were recorded on a dictating machine, and it has been possible for me to refresh my memory of what was said. "Neither agreeable nor disagreeable," I answered. "It just is." "Istigkeit, wasn't that the word Meister Eckhart liked to use? Isness, the being of Platonic philosophy, except that Plato seems to have made the enormous, the grotesque mistake of separating being from becoming and identifying it with the mathematical abstraction of the idea. He could never, poor fellow, have seen a bunch of flowers shining with their own inner light and all but quivering under the pressure of the significance with which they were charged. Could never have perceived that what rose and iris and carnation so intensely signified was nothing more and nothing less than what they were, a transience that was yet eternal life, a perpetual perishing that was at the same time pure being, a bundle of minute, unique particulars in which, by some unspeakable and yet self-evident paradox, was to be seen the divine source of all existence. I continued to look at the flowers, and in their living light I seemed to detect the qualitative equivalent of breathing. But of a breathing without returns to a starting point, with no recurrent ebbs, but only a repeated flow from beauty to heightened beauty, from deeper to ever deeper meaning. Words like grace and transfiguration came to my mind, and this, of course, was what, among other things, they stood for. My eyes traveled from the rose to the carnation, and from that feathery incandescence to the smooth scrolls of sentient amethyst, which were the iris. The beatific vision, Sat Chit Ananda, being, awareness, bliss, for the first time I understood, not on the verbal level, not by inchoate hints or at a distance, but precisely and completely what those prodigious syllables referred to. And then I remembered a passage I had read in one of Suzuki's essays. What is the Dharma body of the Buddha? The Dharma body of the Buddha is another way of saying mind, suchness, the void, the Godhead. The question is asked in a Zen monastery by an earnest and bewildered novice, and with the prompt irrelevance of one of the Marx brothers, the master answers, "The hedge at the bottom of the garden." And the man who realizes this truth, the novice dubiously inquires, "What, may I ask, is he?" Groucho gives him a whack over the shoulders with his staff and answers, "A golden-haired lion." It had been, when I read it, only a vaguely pregnant piece of nonsense. Now it was all as clear as day, as evident as Euclid. Of course, the Dharma body of the Buddha was the hedge at the bottom of the garden. At the same time, and no less obviously, it was these flowers, it was anything that I, or rather the blessed not I, released for a moment from my throttling embrace, cared to look at. The books, for example, with which my study walls were lined, like the flowers, they glowed, when I looked at them, with brighter colors, a profounder significance. Red books, like rubies, emerald books, books bound in white jade, books of agate, of aquamarine, of yellow topaz, lapis lazuli books, whose color was so intense, so intrinsically meaningful, that they seemed to be on the point of leaving the shelves to thrust themselves more insistently on my attention. What about spatial relationships? The investigator inquired as I was looking at the books. It was difficult to answer. True, the perspective looked rather odd, and the walls of the room no longer seemed to meet in right angles. But these were not the really important facts. The really important facts were that spatial relationships had ceased to matter very much, and that my mind was perceiving the world in terms of other than spatial categories. At ordinary times, the eye concerns itself with such problems as where, how far, how situated in relation to what. In the mescaline experience, the implied questions to which the eye responds are of another order. Place and distance cease to be of much interest. The mind does its perceiving in terms of intensity of existence, profundity of significance, relationships within a pattern. I saw the books, but was not at all concerned with their positions in space. What I noticed, what impressed itself upon my mind, was the fact that all of them glowed with living light, and that in some the glory was more manifest than in others. In this context, position and the three dimensions were beside the point. Not, of course, that the category of space had been abolished. When I got up and walked about, I could do so quite normally, without misjudging the whereabouts of objects. Space was still there, but it had lost its predominance. The mind was primarily concerned not with measures and locations, but with being and meaning. And along with indifference to space, there went an even more complete indifference to time. There seems to be plenty of it, was all I would answer when the investigator asked me to say what I felt about time. Plenty of it, but exactly how much was entirely irrelevant. I could, of course, have looked at my watch, but my watch, I knew, was in another universe. My actual experience had been, was still, of an indefinite duration, or alternatively, of a perpetual present made up of one continually changing apocalypse. From the books, the investigator directed my attention to the furniture. A small typing table stood in the center of the room. Beyond it, from my point of view, was a wicker chair, and beyond that, a desk. The three pieces formed an intricate pattern of horizontals, uprights, and diagonals, a pattern all the more interesting for not being interpreted in terms of spatial relationships. Table, chair, and desk came together in a composition that was like something by Braque or Juan Gris, a still life recognizably related to the objective world, but rendered without depth, without any attempt at photographic realism. I was looking at my furniture not as the utilitarian who has to sit on chairs to write at desks and tables, and not as the cameraman or scientific recorder, but as the pure aesthete whose concern is only with forms and their relationships within the field of vision or the picture space. But as I looked, this purely aesthetic cubist's eye view gave place to what I can only describe as the sacramental vision of reality. I was back where I had been when I was looking at the flowers, back in a world where everything shone with the inner light and was infinite in its significance. The legs, for example, of that chair, how miraculous their tubularity, how supernatural their polished smoothness. I spent several minutes, or was it several centuries, not merely gazing at those bamboo legs, but actually being them, or rather being myself in them, or to be still more accurate, for I was not involved in the case, nor in a certain sense were they, being my not-self in the not-self which was the chair. Reflecting on my experience, I find myself agreeing with the eminent Cambridge philosopher Dr. C. D. Broad, that we should do well to consider much more seriously than we have hitherto been inclined to do the type of theory which Bergson put forward in connection with memory and sense perception. The suggestion is that the function of the brain and nervous system and sense organs is in the main eliminative and not productive. Each person is at each moment capable of remembering all that has ever happened to him and of perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. The function of the brain and nervous system is to protect us from being overwhelmed and confused by this mass of largely useless and irrelevant knowledge, by shutting out most of what we should otherwise perceive or remember at any moment, and leaving only that very small and special selection which is likely to be practically useful. According to such a theory, each one of us is potentially mind at large. But insofar as we are animals, our business is at all costs to survive. To make biological survival possible, mind at large has to be funneled through the reducing valve of the brain and nervous system. What comes out at the other end is a measly trickle of the kind of consciousness which will help us to stay alive on the surface of this particular planet. To formulate and express the contents of this reduced awareness, man has invented and endlessly elaborated those symbol systems and implicit philosophies which we call languages. Every individual is at once the beneficiary and the victim of the linguistic tradition into which he has been born. The beneficiary, inasmuch as language gives access to the accumulated records of other people's experience, the victim, insofar as it confirms him in the belief that reduced awareness is the only awareness, and as it bedevils his sense of reality, so that he is all too apt to take his concepts for data, his words for actual things. That which, in the language of religion, is called this world, is the universe of reduced awareness, expressed and, as it were, petrified by language. The various other worlds with which human beings erratically make contact are so many elements in the totality of the awareness belonging to mind at large. Most people, most of the time, know only what comes through the reducing valve and is consecrated as genuinely real by the local language. Certain persons, however, seem to be born with a kind of bypass that circumvents the reducing valve. In others, temporary bypasses may be acquired either spontaneously or as the result of deliberate spiritual exercises, or through hypnosis, or by means of drugs. Through these permanent or temporary bypasses there flows not indeed the perception of everything that is happening everywhere in the universe, for the bypass does not abolish the reducing valve, which still excludes